position number 10602, reel 28.
Mr. Elliott, reel 28. I'd just like to ask you about the Blitz, because you were there in the middle of London in 1940. Did it affect you at all?
Well, the only effect it had, we did fire picket. The HES didn't do any of that. But there was about four Lance Corporals and one Sergeant. Well, all the Lance Corporals was in charge of the fire picket, which they did from more or less retreat to Rivoli. There would be one NCO and three men.
And what roles did they play?
The patrol, one on patrol, the full two on and four off. 2 hours on and 4 hours off, under the supervision of the Lance Corporal, the NCO. And
did you practice any sort of routines for if incendiary bombs or other?
Well, there was no training given. There was fire buckets and sand buckets around, and you knew where they were, so you would just direct your men to go to them and to cover them. Or there was two ways out. There was under the school, you could go in at one end and come out at the other underneath the school, so you could use it as an emergency at either end. And the ATS slept underneath the school, their billets, and there was officers under the school.
Yes, during an air raid, where did you go for the air raid shelter to take?
No, we didn't go. We just patrolled and waited to see if there was any anything to happen. You see, we were underneath a building, a large building.
Oh, I see. So you were actually underground.
We were underground and it was there. But when the alarm went, the sentry would still patrol, and the NCO would be they would be on alert, where they could rest. If there was nothing happening, the rest of the picket could rest.
But did you take part in fire pickets every night, or was
not every night? Every so often, when it was your turn, you did it. The same with all the men. The men changed around every night. It wasn't the same men.
Was the area of London that you were in at St Paul's School very badly bombed?
Not while I was there. I can remember bombs dropping. You know, you could hear them dropping in various other parts of London. But I can't recall any dropping close to where the headquarters was. Not the time I was there. But sometime in 1941, we were told that there was an expected parachute drop in that area. Now, I don't know how they got to know that, but and we were detailed to take defensive positions up all around the school, within the perimeter of the school. And my place was on the main west road, near the headmaster's house, on the front of the school. There was a small lawn there, and I wanted to dig in to do two or three weapon slits so that the troops under my command could be there underground, covered. And I was refused permission to dig in. So when I was refused permission to dig in, I came to the conclusion that there was only an exercise and not a true report of parachute landing.
Just a scare, as it were.
I thought it was just training, just an emergency training, and not as had been stated.
How long did you stay at St Paul's School for?
I'm not quite sure about that. It was in maybe the end of, towards the end of 1940 or the beginning of 1941.
Where did you move to next?
To Latimer Court, where all the officers were separated, where there was a number of generals and an air vice marshal and a Royal Navy captain were in this headmaster's house, And by the way, in the headmaster's house, there was a room set aside for the Duke of Gloucester, as he had something to do with the general staff. And if he wished to come from where he was at, he could come to a room in the headmaster's house. There was one place kept special for him. I was never in that room because it was looked after by the ATS.
Did your duties change at all when you moved to Latimer Court, or were they the same?
No, just the same. It was only just a place of sleeping or living. And then one day in 1941, early 1941, I was told by the general on one night when I was attending to him, either before or after he'd had dinner, that we would be going on GHQ Royal GHQ special train Rapier from King's Cross. And I said, where are we going? Are we going up home? He said, no, we're going into East Anglia. He said, and we'll be taking an American colonel with us. And he says, you'll be looking after him. And he says, you look after him well. Oh, I said, he's not the same rank as you. I said, he'll get looked after. He says, look after him well. He says, because he may be a very important person to us. So...
What time would this be, 1941?
Oh, in the spring sometime. I can't remember quite clearly when. But...
It was before America had entered the war.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, before that. And I asked the general one, while we were on the train, I says, what the world have we got a Yankee on the train for? He says he's going to survey East Anglia to see what areas they could make aerodromes. And that was the only information I got. And I forgot that colonel's name. But on the first night, after I attended to my boss, and I went to clean his, put his gear right and clean his whatever gear in, I knocked on the compartment door. And he said, what do you want? I said, well, I'm looking after you. He says, you're not, I look after myself. I said, oh no, I said, not on this train. I said, I'm looking after you. I said, that's the orders from my boss. And I said, I don't want to get wrong off my boss for not looking after you. So he said, well, what the world do you do? I says, well, don't you have Batman in your army? Or a servant, somebody to look after you? He says, no, we look after ourselves. And I thought that was amazing. I never knew colonels looked after themselves in any army. But anyway, I looked after them. And when I left the train, when we returned back to London and left the train, he shook hands and thanked us for looking after him. But I even forgot his name, but he wasn't a bad sort. I would like to have known him better. You know, I would like to have looked after him a wee while and had a bit crack with him. But at the time was so brief and they were so busy.
How long did this journey last to East Anglia? Did you travel right way through East Anglia on this train?
I think it was 2 days. You know, one day out and overnight sleeping somewhere, then around again and come back to London at night the next day, I think it was.
Did the train have any sort of special appointments to it? I mean, apart from the fact it was... obviously.
Oh, aye, the staff. The cooking staff was on, and there was security staff, and there was people to link the train up with into telephone wires and all that. Oh, yes.
So it could be kept in constant touch?
Constant touch, aye.
And were there sleeping quarters on the train? Was it
Yes, there was first class compartments for the officers, and we had the, we slept on the seats of the rest of the train. It was reasonably comfortable compared to wooden floors, wasn't it? Oh, aye.
Was it a large train? Did it have many carriages to it?
I couldn't see about that. There would be a first class coach, there would be a restaurant coach, maybe about 4 coaches or 5 coaches. There would be a coach when we later used the train at the beginning of 42. When we went to Scotland, there was coaches on which would carry the staff cars. So many staff cars. That was the Rolls Royce of the Commander-in-Chief. And maybe a couple of cars. Oh, aye.
Okay. So following this journey on the special train, what did you do after that?
Went back to London, just carried on normal. And then I think there was the Dieppe raid. I know one day ago, well, when the Dieppe raid happened, when we knew it, when we'd been told over the radio it had happened, General Martel said, you know, Elliot, he said, I would love to be in aircraft over Dieppe. I said, you must be mad. I said, after the last experience over there, I said, you wouldn't get out. He said, wouldn't it be good to go and watch somebody else doing something? I said, you wouldn't watch it. I said, you'd be sewn in the channel. I said, no, I'm not a good swimmer, you know. And he laughed like anything. But he was serious. He would have loved to have been above that. He would have loved to have been in an aeroplane, not me. I'm not the Air Force. I'm a terra firma. But, and then again in 1941, I'm not quite sure of the time, but one night he came from his office and he said, Elliot, he said, do you know, I would like to go to a coal mine, go right to the coal face and start hewing coals. I said, get away, don't be daft. I said, you couldn't do it. I said, anyway, what do you want to go down there for? He says, well, it would be nice for somebody to worry about me instead of me worrying about 80,000 men. And that was the first time I ever heard him, you know, talk about maybe wanting a rest. And then not long after that, he said, I'm going down to the Brown Cottage at Camberley to do some work in my workshop.
Is that his own home?
That's his own home. And he said, you needn't come if you don't want to, but he said, if you come, he says, you'll be working. He says, I want my lawns cut. And he said, I've got nobody to cut them but you if you want to come. He says, you needn't come if you don't want to. Now again, this is the humanity of the man I had known. And I said to him, if you want me to come down to your house to cut the lawns, that's no problem. I said, if I can cut them, I'll come and cut them. And we went down there on a Friday night and returned on the Sunday night. And I was cutting his lawns on the Saturday when I could and on the Sunday before we came back. Now, while we were at his house on the Saturday night, there was a knock at the door. And I went to the door, and there was a general there. Well, he was dressed. I'm saying general because he was dressed. I know he was a general later, but I didn't know who he was then. So I opened the door. He said, is Q in? I said, no, might be asking for Q. I says, I don't know Q. I knew he was talking about my boss. He said, I'm a friend of Q's. I said, not until I've seen your identity card, you're not. And I knew no more, but I heard that my boss was standing, just come out of the room, and he was standing behind us. And this other person straight past me, and they grabbed each other. They were very close friends. And General Martel said to me, he says, what's going on here, Elliot? I said, well, this person won't show his identity card, and I said, I wouldn't let him in until he did. And just then the general's wife came out, Lady Martel, and he just grabbed her as if she was a bundle of rags and swung her around. So they were obviously very close friends. And then the general, his name was Grissett, he'd just come from Singapore. And he said, what's your regiment? I said, the Durham. She says, I knew Q. He says, you couldn't do without them lads from the northeast, could you? And of course they were laughing and pulling their legs. And the next question I got from General Grissett was, is Durham Cathedral still standing? I said, what do you know about Durham Cathedral? He said, I come from Tyneside. He says, I look for the cathedral every time I pass in the train. I said, well, I said, it is still standing. He says, well, one's heard of so many raids in the northeast. He says, you always feel it's Durham Cathedral that they're going for because it's a large object. I said, well, it's still standing. They haven't dropped any bombs around there, sir.
Okay. Can you now tell me your movements through 1942? You stayed with Martel during that time?
At the beginning of 1942, there was going to be a big armoured fighting force vehicles exercise near Dumfries in Scotland. And the commander-in-chief and certain other popular people or highly important people were going on a special train, and we arrived at a small village called Thornhill on the Duke of Buccleuch estate. And before we got there, I was told I would have to look after another general. When we were leaving London, I was told I would have to look after another general. And I didn't know who that general was until I got to the train, again from King's Cross. And the general was Lieutenant General Montgomery. Sir Bernard Law Montgomery. I think he was either corps commander of either 3 Corps or 5 Corps at that time. And we got on the train, and I sorted my boss's toiletries and things, everything out on the coat in his compartment. Then I went to General Martel's and I put all his gear out the same way as I would have put any other officer's gear out.
You meant Montgomery's?
Aye.
Yeah.
Montgomery's came second, my boss, and my boss said I would have to look after Montgomery. I said, he'll get the same treatment as you. I said, but you'll come first. I always place General Martel first before anybody else. I wouldn't like that, you know, to be taken any other way. He was my boss, and as far as I was concerned, he came first. Anybody else, it wouldn't matter who it was, they would have come second.
Did you form any impressions of Montgomery from your brief contact with him?
When I first met him in his quarters on the train, I knew he was something special. Don't ask me how to explain that, but it's a soldier's instinct. It was my instinct that he was something special. I had never heard of the man, I'd never seen him until that time.
Did he actually have anything to say to you? Did you call any conversation?
Not that particular time when I first said he's... But when night came, he sent for me after that dinner, and normally we would have been free then. He sent for me, and I went to his quarters, and he said, there's something missing from my bedside table. And I went through, you know, everything is this, it, that. I said, everything's there that a soldier needs. I said, I can't think of anything I've missed. He says, there's still one important thing missing from my table. And I went through them again. I said, sir, you will have to tell me what it is. I says, because I haven't got a clue. I said, everything is there that you require. He says, everything's not there. I says, well, sir, tell me what it is. I says, this is the first time I've ever looked after you. I says, I just don't know what is different between you and General Martel. I said, everything's the same for General Martel. He's not complaining. And I said, I've done everything the same for you. And I said, you're saying there's something missing. And I said, I just cannot think what that is. He says, where is my Bible? I says, where all good soldiers put it. He says, where do good soldiers put the Bibles? He says, bottom of the kit bags. He says, well, this good soldier likes his Bible on the table. So I had to duck into his kit and get his Bible, yes. And I put the Bible there for him. Now, the next morning, I took him his tea and sort, you know, tidied his place up like I tidied General Martel's up. And the generals, all the staff, were getting ready to go to these manoeuvres when there was sudden commotion on the train. And one of the ATS girls came to me and she said, George, go along to General Montgomery's quarters. He's leaving immediately. So I went along, and General Montgomery had packed almost all of his kit himself, instead of sending for me, as it seemed time was an emergency. So I said, why didn't you send for me, sir? I said, I would have. He said, Elliot, That would have wasted time. And he says, I'm not used to wasting time. So I said, well, I'll finish off what there is. And I got stuck in quickly. And I packed all his gear neatly as it possibly could. And then I carried it out to the transport, the staff car which was there, and they took him to Dumfries Station, where he was put on a special train about midday, or a train, the stop the train special. And he was in London. And the next I knew of him, he was out in North Africa. And he took over the 8th Army. And when he left, as he was leaving, he shook hands with me, and he says, you've done well to look after me, Elliot. He says, I'll not forget it. But I never met the man again.
Which is the way of the army, isn't it?
It is. This is what I said at the beginning, you know.
Okay, can you take me through 1942 now? What else did you...
Well, shortly after that, General Martel was ordered to go to the Middle East and the Far East to check on the armoured fighting vehicles and forces. And I wasn't allowed to go with him. And he arranged for me to return to the regiment, but to an Holden, what was known as a Holden unit, which was the 70th Battalion at Barnet Castle. He said, General Martel said, when I come back, I'll send for you. Well, he went to the Middle East, and while he was out in the Middle East, his daughter was killed in a riding accident near Frimley Green. They were living in Camberley, and she'd gone for a horse ride, and the horse had took fright, and she was knocked off her horse, and she was killed. That was his only daughter. So his daughter was killed while he was away. I saw that in the press. I didn't personally have anything to do with it because I was in the northeast of England then.
Did you ever come into contact with Martel again?
No, never. And
can you tell me about what you were doing then at the 70th Battalion?
Well, when I arrived at the 70th Battalion, I had to report to the orderly room, which you had to do. You report to the police when you went into the guard room to say you were arriving, and then they would tell you where the orderly room was. And I went to the orderly room, and the regimental sergeant major I met had been a corporal in the 2nd Battalion when I was in the 2nd, so I knew him. And I reported to him, and he said, well, you better see the CEO. And when I went in, it was Jeffries, my first boss as a batman in the army. He was lieutenant colonel commanding that battalion, and I didn't know it until I went to the office. Anyhow, when I went in, he shook hands, and you know, we talked about the old days a little bit, and I asked him about the family, and they'd had a daughter, another daughter, which was two daughters. And he said, well, look, he said, my provost sergeant was injured in an accident, and he's in hospital, and he'll not be back for a long time if he comes back. So he says, if you do the job of provost sergeant for 3 months, he said, I'll promote you to sergeant from lance corporal. He said, you needn't worry about your hackney rank. He said, you are a paid lance corporal as from now, and if you do the job for 3 months, you'll be a sergeant. I didn't like being a policeman, but I was getting the chance in 3 months to go from more or less a private soldier to a full rank sergeant. And as I was a married man then and a son, I thought, well, I may as well get the three stripes and can transfer. So I accepted the job, and I think I did a good job.
Can you tell me about your duties as a provost sergeant?
Well, that's discipline of that unit. You're within the perimeter of that unit's area. You are the policeman, and the policeman under you obey your orders, and they carry it out. And they carry it out regimental standing orders, camp standing orders, and garrison standing orders. Wherever it is, you carry out those orders through all ranks, except officers. You don't touch officers.
Yes. How many men did you have working with you and under you?
I forget that one. That's a question. It was about 10, maybe? Up to about 10, but there wouldn't be more than that. Maybe it's that.
and your power, as it were, was within the camp. You weren't going outside the camp.
Oh no, no, within the camp. But if there was any misdemeanour between Barnet Castle and the camp, if the military police wasn't there, I could go out there and bring them in and place them.
Did you ever have to?
No, no.
Can you tell me about your daily routine as a provost sergeant?
Well, I would detail the men under me to be on duty and to where the duties were, which was namely the canteen. There would be maybe one or two policemen on the canteen and one patrolling around the camp just to see that nothing unusual was happening. And then I would have to see to anyone doing detention that was prisoners, and they would be escorted by the policeman to wherever the duties they would be doing, and there was a number and some waiting to go to detention barracks under the military prison staff.
That and was outside of the Barnet Castle.
But that would, my job was to escort them there to the military detention barracks.
Where was that?
Generally Sowerby Bridge. I would take them, and I would take them under escort. I would have maybe another policeman with me.
Would these men come from the 70th?
DLI, yeah. All DLI.
Yeah.
Oh yes, they were all DLI.
Okay, so that might be something you would do once a month, once a week, or
various times. Maybe twice in 1 week, and maybe miss for months or something like that. But as it happened, I had completed. In the meantime, the CO had changed over. Colonel Jeffries had moved on. He'd received an order to command a brigade, and a new CO came. And when I had my interview with him after the 3 months, I said I'd been promised sergeant after 3 months if I'd done the job correctly. And Colonel Fillingham, the new CO, he said, "But you haven't done 3 months under me." Well, I said, "Well, in that case, I better go back to duty." I said, "To get someone else to do provo duties." I said, "A promise was made to me by the previous CO that if I carried out the duties for 3 months correctly, I would be promoted to take over provo sergeant." And I said, "No, you saying no." Well, he said, "If you want to go back to duty, you can go back." So I went back to duty, normal duties.
Before you perhaps tell me about that, can you just we got through the daily routine as far as perhaps taking.
Well, that was as much as.
Do you have any routine in the evening, the afternoon and evening?
No, it is just as the policeman went to the canteen and just patrolled the camp, just to see there was nothing happening, and you supervised defaulters, but then you handed that over to the police, which again was supernumerary duties to the police. They would carry out the fatigue duties, whatever it was the police had to do. You were just there more or less like an head, and to give out the orders. You would be at the orderly room. If there was anyone on CO's orders, you'd be at the orderly room to see what punishment they got, and you'd record it. Then you'd expect that man to turn up on the times as stated in the unit orders.
Okay. Following your return to normal duties, can I ask you first of all, why didn't you opt to do another 3 months, because you'd still presumably be promoted ultimately?
Well, the point was that CO could move again in 3 months, and it